Welcome to the Design the Future podcast, where we talk with women leading the way towards a better built world. Design the Future is hosted by me, Lindsay Baker, with Kira Gould. Let's get started. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Design the Future podcast. It's good to be with you. This is Lindsay.
And this is Kira.
And yeah, here we are. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How about yourself, Lindsay? How are things?
I'm good. I'm realizing I've been asking you that at the beginning of the podcast a lot recently. It would be fun to kind of go back and do like a little, you know, splicing of Lindsay asking Kira how she's doing. And then some weeks you would be like, you know, you can read into the little tone of your voice.
That's right. Yeah. So I don't ever say I'm not well, but I sometimes sound not quite sure about how well I'm doing.
That kind of sounds like, I mean, I very rarely don't think I'm doing well, you know, like, or else I would call you and say, let's not record the podcast today. I'm not well.
Exactly. Or,
yeah. A good friend of mine started saying this towards the beginning of the pandemic. We would catch up and she would say, I am not thriving.
Well, that's good. I like that.
It was good. And it was a good way of her sort of understanding for herself. There is a difference between, you know, I'm in a horrible place or I'm doing really well. And what she was clearly saying is like, this lifestyle, and that was sort of beginning of the pandemic lifestyle.
Yep.
It is, you know, she's an extrovert. And so it was for her a way of saying like, I do not like that I can't be with all my people. That is a problem for me.
Absolutely.
But I'm working, you know, you're persevering, I guess.
Absolutely. Well, and we're now going through a different sort of adaptation phase, I think, mm-hmm. or at least mm-hmm. I am. I was just thinking about the pandemic and maybe the age that you are when you go through it is then proportional to how long it takes you to adapt to post-pandemic life.
I don't know that it's like it's not like a age correlation and exactly as in, you know, the older you are, the more that this happens. But there's definitely, I see a lot of patterns depending on the stage of life or sort of whatever your lifestyle is, like, you know, the way that the parents with small children versus the parents with older children are handling things versus those of us who don't have kids. Yeah, I was just thinking because I'm going to Washington, D.C. next week for work, and I'm going to have dinner with a friend who has small children. And I'm really happy that she is willing to go out on a weeknight and have dinner with me, you know, like in downtown D.C. and that I don't have to come up and sort of like try to fit into their night schedule of, you know, putting the kids to bed kind of thing. As those of us without children, you know, often get asked to do these things. And they always the most fun way to try to genuinely hear how your friend is doing, you know, and to really catch up. But it is like, I was thinking about how in our early 20s living in DC, we spent so much time just weeknight evenings in downtown DC, you know, and now it feels like such a stretch to be like, weeknight dinner, let's do it. Ooh.
Totally. No, absolutely. That's very interesting. Yeah. I mean, and I'm having to reformulate some of my work patterns because people are now starting to want to see people in person, which is great. I love being out in the world. It's wonderful. But I have a productivity pattern now that is mostly because I am at my desk most of the time. So it's disruptive.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to, that's a theme for me for 2023 is finding that balance between being, you know, home, working, and all of the energy the sort of cycles of energy that I've figured out there and then getting back on the road. I wonder how many of you are going through that. I think it's kind of an interesting rebalancing. And I understand that, you know, Kira and I might be in an increasing actual like minority of folks who are still full time working from home. So I know for a lot of you, it's like that work going back into the office environment for some of the time. But either way, I think it's a good year for us to all give ourselves a little bit of space to navigate the differences in like our site, you know, the sort of the energy that it takes to do these things and how that's different. I don't I see it. Hopefully we're all giving ourselves a little bit of wiggle room to figure that out this year. Not to say that it won't change again next year,
That's right.
but nonetheless, I think we're all used to sort of being able to get into a work pattern and we just do it and we don't, it doesn't take effort, you know. It's just like, oh, I get up, I go to work, I take public transit and I get there and I do the thing and then I leave, you know. We're
Yep.
no longer, it's not that mindless anymore. It's just interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, good luck with it. Good luck with all of your, you know, new in-person events. I'm glad to hear. I hope they go well, and I hope you don't get sick.
Oh, I thank you very much. I'm sure they will be great.
Well, let's transition to our guest for today. This is going to be a wonderful conversation. I'm very honored, and I hope that you all are as excited as we are for the conversation that is about to happen, because I don't know, few people I think have the perspective that our guest does on what's next for our movement and our industry. So today we are very excited to welcome Stephanie Green from RMI to the podcast. Welcome, Stephanie.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Oh, we are so excited that you're here. So for everyone that doesn't know Stephanie, I'm just going to do a quick bio. Stephanie is a managing director at RMI, where she leads the Carbon Free Buildings program and helped launch RMI's Building Electrification Initiative. RMI's Buildings program enables a cost-effective, sustainable, and equitable path to building decarbonization with work spanning the US, China, and India. Prior to joining RMI, Stephanie held a number of leadership roles at Pacific Gas and Electric, PG&E Company, including Director of Clean Transportation, the Chief of Staff to PG&E's former CEO and President, and other roles working on renewable energy policy, energy procurement, and customer energy efficiency and demand response programs. So I'm particularly excited that like Stephanie's bringing this really broad and interesting perspective from, you know, a broader look at carbon and energy and what happens outside of this smaller section of the world that involves buildings. And then she's been now leading the whole sort of buildings facet of RMI for a little bit of time here, and she's going to talk to us about that. So before we get into the really nerdy stuff and RMI's work, Stephanie, would you just tell us a little bit more about your path and how you got involved in climate and sustainability work?
Sure. So I'm going to go way back because I've been working on climate and clean energy and sustainability issues for really my whole career. And it was in 1999 that I took the year off before starting college. And I think it's pretty common now for people to take what's called a gap year. But in 99, it was definitely less common in the US. And people were looking at me like I was a little crazy, like, what are you doing? Why aren't you going straight to college? And I just felt like if I wanted to figure out what I wanted to do with the rest of my life, how could I really do that without seeing life outside the US and outside of a classroom for just a little while to get some more perspective? And so I went to India. I spent some time living in a rural village in Ecuador. I did an environmental field studies course in Nepal. I did a number of different things, mostly in Southeast Asia and South America. And it really just was very eye-opening for me in a lot of ways. And one of the major areas is that I realized there's going to be billions of people impacted by global climate change. And in particular, around the equatorial regions of the world where I was spending time in that year. And it felt like living and working in the US, we are one of the largest contributors to global greenhouse gas emissions. And it felt like I had an obligation then to do something about that, right? And to really make change where I could. And so it was really actually the impact on people that got me most excited about working on climate and sustainability. And I devoted my career to working on it. And so I did an interdisciplinary program in college called Earth Systems, where you study, you know, environmental science, but also engineering, economics, policy, and look more at a systems perspective about how to address environmental change. And then I also went to get an MBA because I felt like it's really critical to understand how do we do this within a market-based system? How do we ensure that there's a win-win with addressing sustainability and climate issues, and also making sure it works for business, and hopefully can be can make money and can change people's lives for the better. So that's my main background. Then I went to PG&E after business school, worked on a broad array of different sustainability topics there, and then came to RMI.
Stephanie, I love that educational journey that you just described. That sounds amazing. What a terrific program in your undergrad work, and then an MBA on top of that seems terrific. And I'm so glad you mentioned systems thinking, because it just seems so central to all of this. But I'd love to know, you know, what people should know about working at a place like RMI. Like, what should they be good at and interested in?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And it's funny because I've worked at several different places, and then coming to RMI, it was like the number one thing that a lot of people at RMI, I think, are interested in or need to be good at is actually systems thinking. So I felt like I'd come full circle to kind of come home. And by that, I mean, really just making sure you're not thinking in a single discipline, but thinking about what is the intersection between, you know, what is the economic decision maker need to think through, what does the engineer need to think about, and how do you come up with solutions that actually create a more optimal result than if you just looked at like one thing or another. And I can give you examples of that in the building space. We could talk about that more. But so I'd say to work at RMI, it's helpful to be a systems thinker or be excited about the concept of systems thinking. The second probably goes without saying, but I'd say you have to be excited about having impact, right? RMI is a mission-focused nonprofit organization working on addressing climate change. And so you should be excited about working on something towards that mission. And then finally, I think it is so important in a career to be curious. That's especially important at a place like RMI, where we're working on a broad array of topics, and frankly, they don't always have clear-cut answers. And so being able to ask really good questions, being excited to learn something new every day, you don't actually need to be an expert in everything, right? You can't be an expert in everything, but can you have expertise in a couple core areas and then use that to ask good questions of others? I think that that will be a really successful approach.
Can you also talk a little bit about why, after working in renewables, sort of on the utility side and with EVs, why buildings after that?
Yeah, so it's so interesting because I'm drawn to buildings for a number of reasons. The first is the impact on people's lives. So again, I'm not saying that all those other areas don't impact people's lives. They do. But there's something about buildings that really touches people so directly that it inspires me. 90% of our lives we spend inside buildings, right? We're in offices, we're in homes. And, you know, think about all of the ways we can make people's lives better if you make buildings better, right? So if you electrify a home, you improve indoor air quality. We'll talk more about that when I talk about some of my team's projects. When you make a home more energy efficient, and when you bring in more natural light, it's a better place to be. You can also make the building more affordable, right? So you can impact people's energy bills really directly. And so that's one of the reasons I was really drawn to it. And the second is I really feel like buildings are the center of all the other topics I've worked on, right? So when we're talking about a sustainability transition and buildings, we're talking about needing to think through EV charging infrastructure and renewable energy procurement for that building, and how that building is interacting with the utility. And there's even places around like siting a building. How do you make sure buildings are creating a car light lifestyle in terms of being located in a place with high walkability and public transit? And then finally, it's about really thinking through how do you address a massive challenge that has really distributed stakeholders. I found that challenge really interesting in a way that if you have a renewable procurement standard at the utility, you're really working with a few key stakeholders to make that happen. Whereas buildings, it's much more distributed. And I think a really interesting challenge to tackle at this moment.
Oh, yeah. I'm so glad to hear you say that. Because in some ways, I think, I don't know, for me, having worked on buildings for, you know, for my career, I look at my friends, you know, that we probably have the same thing where you have people that you met in undergrad who ended up in different, you know, different parts of the climate fight. And I get a little jealous, you know, of like the solar folks much they've been able to get done. And I'm just thinking, did I pick the wrong, like battle that's so complicated over here? But I love the complexity, and I'm very glad that we have someone like you also embracing the complexity of building, because it, I, as you're saying, it's complex, but then at the end of the day, it also means that there are all of these wonderful added complex benefits to doing the work that are just so much more about, the way people live their lives and their health and all of that. So yeah, thank you. Thank you for framing it that way. And I hope everyone else in the, in our listening community hears that aspect of it from Stephanie, that we should feel okay about the fact that some of these things are taking a little longer for us to sort
Yeah.
through,
No, it's totally true. Yeah, I mean, we increased PG&E's renewable energy output because, the regulator passed, there was a legislation, they passed a law, they said, okay, change your energy mix. I'm not saying it was easy, but it's like, okay, and then you have one utility and it serves 1 in 20 Americans. There you go, right? Here it's like we have 110 million buildings across the US alone, right? All these different owners and decision makers and stakeholders. It's a tough challenge.
Yeah, totally. Okay, well, so it's a tough challenge, but we know that you are doing incredible work on it. Do you want to kind of give us a sense of your team at RMI right now and what you're working on and, just like sort of the scope of it?
Sure. Yeah. So my team, as you mentioned at the beginning, works globally. We work primarily at this point in the US, China, and India. And the context here is buildings are 40% of global greenhouse gas emissions. So RMI as a whole, we work on all of the major industry sectors that contribute to global greenhouse gas emissions. And the emissions from buildings come from what several sources. The first is operational carbon. So that's both on-site emissions of burning of fossil fuels, primarily gas, and then a bit of oil and propane to heat our spaces and heat our water and cook. And then also the indirect emissions that come from electricity use on the buildings. And then also something we call embodied carbon. And that is basically the emissions that come over the life cycle of producing the materials that go into buildings. So concrete, steel, insulation, et cetera. And so our mission on the team is to really support an energy transition for buildings that keeps global temperatures below 1.5 degrees C. And so what that means in terms of all industry sectors, including buildings, is we have to have our global emissions in the next 7 years. It's a pretty daunting challenge, frankly. But we can't do everything. So the goal here on my team is to think through what are the tipping points? How can we have high impact, high leverage on key areas that then once they start moving, right, they have a life of their own. They can have more exponential change and exponential impact. And so we slice and dice the world in different ways. One way I think about the world is there's a huge challenge for cooling in the global south around equatorial regions where the primary need is to have energy to cool spaces. And then in the US and the EU and other places, it's a heating challenge. It's about how are we making sure that we're heating our buildings and our water with basically electrifying those heating sources and then using renewable electricity to power those buildings. And then efficiency, so operational efficiency is important across both of those two. So we work on energy efficiency as well. And then I also think about it in terms of a new construction and an existing buildings challenge, right? So our team works across both. So there's some crazy statistics I can share here. Basically, like one new city, the size of New York City. So the square footage of New York City is built every month in the global south. So that's a new construction challenge, right? Like, how do we make sure that's built with no
Wow.
embodied carbon? Yeah, it's crazy, right?
Wow.
So you have a new New York popping up every month, right? And those buildings are also, they're going to last. They're not like a car or a fridge, maybe that lasts 10 years, maybe 20, if you really are maintaining that thing really well. But like these buildings are going to be standing for 60, 70 years, right? So it's like we got to just build new construction right from the start, like starting yesterday. And then we also look at how do we retrofit existing buildings in a way that's cost effective.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I'm still kind of thinking about this New York City thing, which I might just ask you about off the air, because I'm like, what I want is you said it was the entire city of New York, once a it, that gets built in the Global South every month.
Yes.
Oh, it's
Yeah,
so amazing.
square footage equivalent, just to be clear. So it's not
Yeah. No.
necessarily like
Yeah.
a new city is cropping up, but in terms of like
No.
square footage
The square
building
footage.
stock. Yep.
Yeah. No, I love that because, but I think it also kind of, yeah, I'm curious of, I want to know things like, how does that compare to the square footage of the Global North right now? Because it's an interesting, I really love to see, I have loved watching RMI. I think Architecture 2030 is also doing a little bit of this refocusing to the Global South. I'm super excited about it, and I want more people to understand why that is, because, we have a lot of guests on our show who talk a little bit more about how do I leverage the position that I'm in the building industry. I'm an architect, I'm a developer, I work in construction to do the best work. But what I love about talking to folks like you is that you can help us understand our sector as a whole, including the new and the existing. What is its impacts, and how is a group like RMI sort of triaging the largest, as you said, like levers for change? Because I think that might help our colleagues, who are maybe more doing those kind of internal leverage points, understand like this is why we're going to really focus on the Global South right now, or this is what, this is where our focus is in terms of building tools and strategies and all of that. So anyway, it's super exciting. Thank you for that overview. Can you share with us like a few specific projects that you're working on right now that you think are exciting and you want listeners to know about?
Sure. And I have to say, like, I can't even, I'll give a few, and you should just know they're like highlights, right? Because my team, I'm so proud of all of the work we're doing, and not just my team, but like partners in this space, coalitions of actors who are really creating this huge building decarbonization movement. And so, these are just a couple highlights of some of the work. For context, RMI works across both changing policy, which we view as a really critical driver to driving demand for building decarbonization incentives and mandates, as well as working with market actors, large market actors, where we believe we can create change at scale in the market. And then those two feed off each other, right? So like if you have large real estate players or building portfolio owners or contractors calling for using, demanding these new technologies or building zero carbon buildings, that creates more of a mandate for change on the policy side and vice versa, right? So policy might create an initial push, demand for all electric new construction, for example, and then it's once the market begins adopting it, it smooths the way. So a couple projects I'll highlight. One, I'll start in India, actually. So we have a partnership with the Lodha Group, which is one of India's largest private real estate developers, and we're supporting them to achieve a zero carbon goal by 2035 in their real estate portfolio. And we're doing it through this accelerator concept where we're bringing together lots of different, policymakers and architects and engineers to really think through how do we use how Lodha achieves this goal as an example for the real estate sector more broadly in India. And we're working with them on a whole range of things like renewables procurement for their buildings. We're working on embodied carbon in their new construction. We're working on thinking through super efficient cooling appliances in their buildings, as well as passive cooling measures. So it's a really neat project. And then another one I'll highlight because it's been hitting the news quite a lot lately is our work on health. So we actually have been really concerned about the research and peer-reviewed science we've seen for years on the indoor air quality impacts of fossil fuel combustion in our homes, and in particular from gas stoves. And so my team helped co-author a study with the University of Sydney and the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And it was just released in December, and it showed that 12.7% of childhood asthma in the US is associated with gas stove use. And that's like the same fraction of asthma percentage that comes from exposure to secondhand smoke. And so that is a project that is synthesizing decades of literature on science and indoor air quality and gas stoves. And I think it's just really a game changer in terms of how we think about making better buildings and improving indoor air quality through electrification.
I love hearing about that, Stephanie. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I have two young kids, right? I mean, I'm an avid cook. And I frankly didn't think before, like, oh, I'm turning the stove on to boil water for pasta. Like, let me open the windows and get the vent going because I have this, nitrogen dioxide emissions are flooding my kitchen. It just wasn't something that I really thought through very much. And now I have an induction stove and water boils in a minute and it's awesome. So, you know, I think we really can make people's lives better through the same things that can help make a better building. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I really identify with that. It's funny because I haven't switched over my stove yet. I'm still cooking on a flame and opening the windows, just like exactly like you described, because I'm, you know, acutely aware of it now. It's something that I think awareness has really grown with studies like the one that you're talking about contributing to that.
Yeah, thanks. And, you know, it's funny. I mean, I think another thing I hadn't appreciated before I worked on these topics is that indoor air quality, it's not regulated, right? It's like, you, if you're cooking, you know, chicken in your gas stove, it's like you're reaching levels of indoor air pollutants that would be illegal outdoors. And it's like, it's just not the same level of regulation that we have on outdoor air emissions. And so, you know, things like furnaces, that those are vented outdoors, that creates an outdoor air pollution problem we can talk about. But it's just not the same as things that we're combusting inside. One other thing I just wanted to flag on my project. So I'm so excited. I'll just talk your ear off of my projects. I'll stop after this one. But we just came out with a roadmap for the federal buildings portfolio to reduce embodied carbon in their buildings. So we basically are charting a path to achieve zero embodied carbon in the federal building portfolio by 2050. And that we think is really a model for any portfolio owner that they could use to reduce embodied carbon in new construction. So it can be adopted by both the public and the private sector. It turns out, you know, the federal government is America's largest real estate portfolio owner, and they're the largest purchaser of building construction materials. So that's an example of where we're working with, you know, one portfolio owner, one industry player that we think can really have massive impact, tipping points, and scale. And funding from the Inflation Reduction Act is going to really help with that. They devote a lot of funding for low carbon materials in public projects.
Absolutely. Well, and I'm hoping you can tell us actually a little bit more about the Inflation Reduction Act and, you know, what influence you feel that that's going to have on the building sector generally. Why is it important and what should people know about it?
Yeah, it's great. So I am so excited about the Inflation Reduction Act. It's called, I'll refer to it as the IRA. But yeah, it infuses a massive amount of funding into all sorts of decarbonization projects. In the building sector, there's about $50 billion of funding that will provide incentives for clean energy technologies and improvements. And as I said, the reason I'm excited to work on buildings is because it can really also help lower customer energy bills. It's going to impact people's lives, right? So it'll make homes and workplaces and schools, it'll make them healthier, it'll make them safer. So basically there's a lot of places that money goes. It has a target set of incentives for low and moderate income families to participate in the transition. So there's some specific incentives for electrification upgrades that are highest for low and moderate income households. That includes electrical upgrades and purchases of the appliances and equipment that are needed, as well as weatherization. And so, you know, you have a ton of homes across the US that are just not well insulated. And so we need to have more money flowing and paired incentives. So when someone electrifies their home, they can weatherize their home and have lower operational costs, as an example. And so our estimates at RMI are that we think this investment from IRA could help get us to anywhere from 10 to 30% of our 2030 goal to cut building emissions in half. So it's a huge flood of incentive dollars towards the building sector.
That's fantastic. Yeah, it's so exciting. I feel like there's been a lot of, discussion in the news about it, and people are trying to get their heads around how it's actually all going to work and filter out. But it's terrific to hear about those multiple impacts that you're describing. Stephanie, I wonder if you could tell us about something about what you're most proud of accomplishing in your work life. Really could be anything.
Yeah, I thought a lot about this question when you shared you were going to ask me this particular one. I honestly am most proud of what I'm doing now. I don't know what else to say. I'm working with an incredible team of over 70 staff who, frankly, each and every one of them are working on projects or have done things in the past year or two or three on this team that have been changing the world in terms of how we're thinking about building decarbonization. And I want to be clear, it's done, we're standing on the shoulders of giants. We're doing it in partnership with a huge array of advocates and policymakers and private sector actors. But I'm really proud of leading my team. They're just such a talented group of people. And I've been amazed to see our team grow. I came onto the team when it was about half the size. And when electrification wasn't even really a term used as much in the climate movement and building a decarbonization movement, and embodied carbon was less of a common term. And so it's been really fun to watch the narrative change around building decarbonization, thanks to a huge array of colleagues that I work with every day.
That's a great answer. I love it. I mean, and it does sound like, I felt kind of silly asking the question because you've just described all these amazing things that your team is touching literally around the world. So there's a lot to be proud of there. Absolutely. I wonder too, and you can maybe answer for you personally, but also just thinking about that team and all that you guys are doing, do you feel like you're part of a movement or part of an industry? And how do you and your team think about that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I definitely do. And I think to me, the hallmark of movement is where, the lines get blurry between what did I, Stephanie, do, or what did RMI, my team, do or have its hands in versus what is the ripple effect and the influence that is being had across the industry, across multiple different types of stakeholders that go far beyond what any one person can do, but it's about what is exponential impact. And so I think that's where we're starting to see in the building decarbonization world, I think, and again, it's not like my team or me or any one person, it's a collective group of thousands of people working across many different kinds of organizations, and many of them you've had on this podcast, or I talk with on the phone at different days, or I look up to, I read their articles. Like this, that's a movement to me, is a collective whole that's having exponential impact more than any one project or any one person.
Yeah, I love that, and I do. That does sort of. That resonates and certainly has like some of the inspiration behind why we do the pod. It's like just trying to get a sense of this community and what we're all working on. So thank you for that. We want to ask you, I guess maybe more broadly in terms of climate action, where did you think we would be in like the year 2020 or in the 2020s when you started working on this in your career? How are we doing compared to any visions that you might have had when you were younger?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I think that the true answer here is I alternate between frustration and despair and then great hope and optimism. And I think that's okay, right? I think it's kind of the reality. And the despair, or at least like kind of bummed out feeling, comes from, I sat in a class, right? And the early 2000s. In 2000, with Steve Schneider, a very famous climate scientist who sadly passed away, he's like, all right, climate science is real. Like, this is the impact on the world. Like, this is how it's going to impact people. He's repeating things that we'd heard in 1985 in Congress. There were people testifying about climate. And so I feel a little bit like, okay, we've known about this, folks. It's 2023. Like, why are we still building things that are not zero carbon? Like, what? Why are we digging the hole deeper, right? At the very least, I could was hoping we'd have a little bit more progress in terms of not adding a new customer to the gas system every minute, for example. Because that's creating what we're doing now. And I come from a utility, right? I come from a combined gas and electric utility. And to me, that's just like, let's innovate. Let's think through, instead of making an investment in something that might end up being a stranded cost or might be borne out by customers paying for this thing that we know does not align with a zero carbon future. Like, how can we make sure we're making an investment that's going to last for the next 100+ years and not make climate change more of a problem? But the hope, let me switch to the hope, which is that we have seen these tipping points. And that makes me really happy. When I started working, I actually worked on EVs twice when I was at PG&E. And the first time was when I was an intern in the summer of 2011. And it was like EVs weren't even a thing. You know, like people were like, what's an EV? And doesn't that go not go far enough? Or, you know, even renewable energy was such a high price per megawatt hour. And to watch over the past decade how both you know, renewable energy is cheaper or at cost parity than any other alternative. And to watch EV adoption and storage prices, battery prices go down a cost curve faster than any of the projections that were made at the time, that gives me hope and reminds me that change can happen really fast. It can happen at an exponential impact level, and that gives me hope.
Yeah, no, I love that. I think that sums it up really well, you know, like just and I hope that folks can hear that, like how you have to live between those extremes in the work that you do. 'Cause I do think increasingly people can kind of get spun into a bit of a negative cycle, you know, of feeling like how could we possibly dig ourselves out of this. But as you said, it's actually possible, very possible. Yeah, well, where do you for buildings in particular, where do you think we've done best, and where do you think we have to really focus that we haven't done maybe enough yet, or that need to be kind of our areas to double down and kind of like, I don't know, unpack the complexity, figure out how to really address effectively what sort of facets of the building sector.
Well, I think we've done a lot of things right. I'll start there. I mean, I think we're really starting to see change at scale today. I'll start with the fact that, you know, we know how to build an incredible zero carbon building. There's a huge array of architects and engineers. They know how to use integrative design principles. They know how to make a beautiful zero carbon building that is healthier, that is nice to be inside. So that's great. Like the technology, we have the technology to do this. We know how to do it. And the techniques have spread across the architecture community and engineering and design community. I think we also have seen costs come down substantially for a lot of things. Like it's really cost effective to do a huge array of energy efficiency work and projects on buildings. We're seeing policy changes incorporate electrification and embodied carbon. We're seeing things like the Inflation Reduction Act and incentives for electrification and weatherization. And we're seeing a real focus on making sure that low and moderate income households don't pay more for this transition. And really thinking through, like, how do we make sure that those incentives get to the households that need them the most? So I think all of that is really positive progress. I think the challenges are also large. And one of them gets back to, as I mentioned earlier, it's just a bunch of different stakeholders. You don't have like a single utility that's covering the whole state. And then you regulate that utility, you make changes to its energy mix. And I realize that's easier said than done, but it's still one large decision maker or entity. And then you're done. Whereas we have 110 million buildings in the US alone, right? You have contractors, you have developers. 90% of those 110 million buildings are single-family homes. And so how do you get to all of the different stakeholders, the homeowners, the renters, the landlords, the contractors, the developers, the commercial portfolio owners, to influence all of the different areas of that sector? I think we still have to do a better job of educating workforce, of thinking through how the financial sector can help to accelerate this transition. 90% of the buildings are single family homes, but half of the emissions come from commercial real estate. So I think there are areas we can think through what are the right tipping points to push. And then I think education incentive programs. I mean, I think I mentioned, I'm so happy that the IRA has incentives that really target low and moderate income households, but we need to make it so streamlined and easy to get, you know, utilities to communicate their incentive and energy saving programs to the right customers, to make sure that incentive programs are targeting small and medium commercial buildings that make up a very large portion of the real estate footprint, and they often have fewer resources to make upgrades. How do we make sure that the incentives are getting to the right places and that to the right stakeholders?
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, that all feels really important and also sort of engages in that gnarliness that we talked about earlier. There is a lot to do, so we really shouldn't keep you. But we do have this one last question that we like to ask all of our guests. And it's how we'll wrap up with you today. So tell us, Stephanie, who are you most inspired by these days? Any kinds of leaders, any walks of life, whatever folks are doing, what keeps you going?
Yeah, well, I couldn't think of like a single name per se, but I would say just in general, kind of on that spectrum of I alternate from hope and optimism to despair. I think I'm really inspired by people on either side of the climate spectrum. One are people like I have a bunch of friends from undergrad and my master's program that have been working on climate and energy for a couple decades now, and they're still at it, you know, and they're still going and they're working at different companies or they're working in policy and they're working across a whole different, they're working at startups or startups that are now huge companies changing the world. And I think that really inspires me that, you know, a couple decades in, people are still at it. And then I'm also really inspired by, I've had some career changers come to me, like people that have been working and whatever for 2 decades, 3 decades, they say, you know what? Wow. Like I want to work on climate change. What can I do to help? How can I use all these transferable skills I've developed, you know, through my work in the private sector, doing marketing or doing computer software engineering, et cetera, et cetera. How can I use that to address this climate crisis? That inspires me too.
Yeah, that is really wonderful to see. It's like just to know people are starting to show up to lend a hand, whatever kind that is. That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Stephanie. And just thank you for being with us and for giving us this, you know, broad perspective on the work at hand with carbon. It's really great to have you here.
Well, thank you, Lindsay, Kira. You're both really inspiring individuals. And so I was really honored to be invited to this podcast and excited to talk to you both today. It's been really, really fun.
Well, we are just delighted and honored that you are in our community and that you're here to have these conversations with us. So thank you again. And thanks, Kira, for being with me. It's a pleasure.
As always, thank you, Lindsay. And thank you, Stephanie.
Yeah, and that, thank you to all of you. That is it for us this week on the Design the Future podcast. Thanks for listening. Please leave us a review on Apple. It really matters. It helps people find us. Stay safe, and we'll see you next time.